My name is Ben Burrell, and this is Bob Dylan Album by Album, a podcast that brings you an in-depth look at each Bob Dylan studio recording record by record. So we're at the end of Bob's religious period. This is the third and final album of that run. I hope you enjoyed listening to these episodes. I have enjoyed making them because these albums are endlessly fascinating. They're not Bob's best, or at least they're not his most celebrated. But they're fascinating albums for lots of different reasons. This one particularly, as we're about to find out. There's going to be a special episode after this, so stick around to find out what that is all about. I'll reveal all at the end of this episode, and then that'll be it for this season of the podcast. If you have enjoyed listening to this season, then feel free to donate to the podcast. You can buy me a coffee. There's a link in the episode description. Loads of people have done that, and as I always say, thank you so much. It's really appreciated. Hi to Lewis. Hi to Christopher Becker and Tommy Byrne and Mac as well. Hello to Weston, hello to Hugo Stressman, and hi to Tom Willis, hi to Robin Oz and Lee Hewitt, and also Will, who is a monthly supporter, and Tom Kellogg. Nice one for that. If you want to support the podcast, as I say, there's a link in the episode description right now. Let's have a look at Bob's 21st studio album. This is 1981's Shot of Love. This whole period was, if nothing else, a purple patch in terms of quantity for Dylan. He wrote lots of material in a quick amount of time. It was three albums in 3 years, and three distinctly different albums too. The slick Slow Train Coming was lick heavy with a backdrop of an apocalypse, and Saved was a gospel romp through evangelical music. Both had very likeable qualities and an interesting take on its subject matter. Shot of Love, however, is less likable. It sticks to the subject matter of the previous two records, but here Dylan is angrier and more petulant, and also strangely less obsessed with religion. The LP's sonics are a mess, and the songs overall are just less enjoyable. But like we've seen with previous albums in this run, it's not as bad as some would have you believe. Bob began writing the album in the summer of 1980. Album tracks like Property of Jesus and The Groom Still Waiting at the Altar, and some songs that didn't make the LP, like the drearily titled Yonder Comes Sin, were all composed during this time. As was a tune called Caribbean Wind. It stood out. It was still rooted in religion, but it was the first sign that Dylan would move away from this lyrical theme in the not-too-distant future. The song itself sounds like a mashup between Street Legal and Saved. It also had a feeling of the not-yet-written Tight Connection to My Heart from the Empire Burlesque album. It finds Dylan throwing a galloping melody into a cauldron of organs, drums, and, unbelievably, someone making wind sounds on the microphone. Bob even felt it was ready to be debuted on tour in late 1980 at a show in San Francisco. It was the only song from the Shot of Love sessions to make it on the setlist that night, but it would end up falling out of favour. Prior to this, Bob had run through some of the album's songs in mid-September at his Rundown Studios in Santa Monica, California. That's the building from the front cover of Street Legal. In fact, you can hear songs from this time like Every Grain of Sand on the Bootleg Series Volumes 1 to 3, Rare and Unreleased, 1961 to 1991. In March the next year, Dylan held more formal sessions at both Rundown and Studio 55 in LA, where he rehearsed some of his new compositions whilst trialling a potential producer, Jimmy Iovine. On the third day of the sessions, they focused on trying to capture Caribbean Wind, but it didn't go well. Dylan grew increasingly pessimistic about the song's prospects. He tried to get it right at this point in March and was still plugging away at the same song during a session in May, this time with a different producer in a different studio. It clearly wasn't meant to be. Despite the fact to us that the song sounds finished and is a great song, clearly it wasn't working for Bob. Another new composition, Angelina, was recorded at this point with much greater success. It's a sweeping, very 80s sounding ballad that almost tops 7 minutes. Well, it's always been my nature to take chances. My right hand drawing back while my left hand advances. Where the current is strong and the monkey dances. Looking at the recording schedule, it's exhausting. There's just so many songs here, which is frustrating considering we get the album we do. It could have, like we've seen so many times before, been very different. Just like the next album, Infidels, Bob leaves off some brilliant songs, choosing to populate the album with tracks of inferior quality. After the initial run of studio time in March, various sessions were booked across Los Angeles, but they didn't bear any fruit. Sometime in late April, veteran producer Bumps Blackwell popped in to see Dylan. Blackwell is best known for his work with Little Richard. He co-wrote Good Golly Miss Molly, for example, amongst lots of other songs. He ended up producing that day's sessions. He supervised recordings of Trouble and Shot of Love, both of which were later selected for the album, and a song called Magic, which was not. He didn't produce the rest of the LP, though, possibly due to health reasons. This would be the last record he was ever involved with, and he died 4 years later of pneumonia. By the end of April, Chuck Plotkin, who had worked with Bruce Springsteen, was eventually hired by Dylan as the album's producer proper. As a side note, Plotkin would have the task of turning the raw, unprocessed cassette tapes of the Springsteen Nebraska album, which had spent weeks in Springsteen's trouser pocket, into a professional-sounding vinyl LP. He would also put together the Jerry Maguire soundtrack, which featured both Dylan and Bruce. Five sessions were scheduled for Plotkin's Clover Studio, beginning on April the 27th and ending on May the 1st. There they cut songs like Property of Jesus and Watered Down Love, Heart of Mine and Lenny Bruce and Dead Man, Dead Man, In the Summertime and Every Grain of Sand, all of which received usable takes for the album. They also had another go at Caribbean Winds 2, and once again it appears not to have gone well. Finally, on the 12th of May, Dylan and Plotkin felt like they had a finished version of the LP. However, after listening to it the next day, they weren't so sure. They tinkered with the track listing, removing songs like Angelina and Magic from the final run. The other songs remained, but even then, Dylan decided to re-record several of those songs. Plotkin and Dylan apparently had conflicting ideas about how to mix the songs. The producer made numerous prototype mixes, delivering each one on a cassette dub over to Dylan at Rundown Studios. Most, if not all of them, were rejected. Chuck wanted to get a nice mix at the end of each song, recalls drummer Jim Keltner, and Bob wouldn't have any nice mixes. Most of everything you hear on Shot of Love turns out to be monitor mixes. Plotkin spent another month mixing the album and overdubbing the songs that were selected for the final record. Mixing was finally completed on June the 7th, with overdubs continuing through to June the 16th. In many ways, he shouldn't have bothered about the mix. Like the production, it's the main thing that lets the album down. Listen to track 3, Property of Jesus. It sounds like it's just been thrown onto tape. It's the property of Jesus. We sent him to the ball. You got something there. You got a heart of stone. This sound was fine on Saved, with its gospel overtones and celebratory nature with flourishes of R&B and funk. That sounded like a joyous group of people making a racket. But here, the kitchen sink mix doesn't do the Sonics justice, possibly because we lean more onto rock on this LP. Property of Jesus just sounds a little cluttered at times. Hiding Under the Stodge is a tune with a good hook and some nice big brass, but even that's buried in the mix. The lyrics are less enjoyable. Some see them as satire, I don't. I see them as a straightforward defence of religion with an offence. In the opener, Bob sings, "Go ahead and talk about him because he makes you doubt. Because he has denied himself the things you can't live without. Laugh at him behind his back just like the others do. Remind him of what he used to be when he comes walking through. He's the property of Jesus, resent him to the bone. You've got something better, you've got a heart of stone." The first line there is a nod to abstaining from sex before marriage or alcohol or bacon or anything that any religion forbids. It's a turning of the tables on someone who criticizes the religious person's abstinence by asking why the non-religious person can't live without these things. The anger in this song continues into the second verse with the lines, "Stop your conversation when he passes on the street. Hope he falls upon himself, oh won't that be sweet. Because he can't be exploited by superstition anymore. Because he can't be bribed or bought by the things that you adore." At this point, you get the impression Bob is singing about this situation from experience. He's encountered his fair share of sneers from this period of his career, We even saw John Lennon's agitated song reply to Dylan in an earlier episode. The person on the street could easily be Bob. During the song, his anger becomes apparent. In the final verse, for example, he seethes, "You can laugh at salvation, you can play the Olympic Games. You think that when you rest at last, you'll go back from where you came." Whilst I'm not the biggest fan of the song, in an attempt at fairness, I have to say we love a sneering Dylan when it comes to songs like Positively 4th Street or Like a Rolling Stone or Idiot Wind. So why, for the most part, don't we like it as much here? Well, from those songs, rightfully or wrongfully, we get the impression as a listener that Dylan has been crossed in some way. Dumped out of a relationship, or he's seen turning on him for his new music, or a rich girl who should have known better. They all make for good antagonists. Here, though, he's moaning at atheists, who don't make for the best antagonists because, well, for a start, they make up a lot of Dylan's fan base and they haven't particularly wronged Bob, unlike some of the other subject matters. That anger found in this song is a bedrock for a lot of the record. "Satan got you by the heel, there's a bird's nest in your hair. Do you have any faith at all? Do you have any love to share?" he sings on the grumpy Dead Man, Dead Man. And on "Groom Still Waiting at the Altar," we hear being treated like a farm animal on a wild goose chase. Once again on this song, we're back with that cluttered production and the mix feels like it was thrown against the wall and then chucked onto tape. However, at least with this song's furious delivery, it isn't as jarring as it is elsewhere on the album. In fact, it's quite a thrill. Bob is so furious, you can't help but get carried away with him. Even if the sonics are so achingly obvious, from that Blues by Numbers chord shift to its Blues by Numbers riff, it really doesn't stand out apart from Bob's delivery. Worse still is that Dylan also breaks a rule he doesn't often break. He throws a bad line into the chorus, meaning it's a bad line that's repeated throughout the song, and it's the first line of the chorus too. "West of Jordan, east of the Rock of Gibraltar," he sings. It's the Rock of Gibraltar bit for me. It's not really a place that holds too much gravitas. No disrespect to the Spanish-English Jurassic limestone, but it just doesn't. It's almost comical how Bob references it here. It just feels very random. Of course, the actual location could be anywhere from Athens to Malaga or Malta to Italy. But given this is a religious album, Jerusalem also fits the bill in this placing, sort of. Wherever it is, if indeed it is anywhere, it doesn't stop the fact that the weird lyrics continue in this song. We slide into an absurdist fever dream that spills over into a piece about the changing world. There's chaos all around. We hear it in the lines like, "Cities on fire, phones out of order. They're killing nuns and soldiers. There's fighting on the border." And elsewhere, "Put your hand on my head, baby. Do I have a temperature?" The narrator rants about someone called Claudette, who appears to be a former love. He spitefully says he doesn't know where she is. She could be running a whorehouse in Buenos Aires, he tells us at one point. The relationship appears not to have ended well. "Don't know what I can say about Claudette that wouldn't come back to haunt me," Bob tells us on the opener of the third verse. She doesn't appear to be a religious person, given that whorehouse comments, which could lead us to believe that she represents his former life, a life of sin. He's left her behind because the world is changing. There's change afoot in the whole song. It feels like the world is falling apart as we're treated to some apocalyptic lines like the "Cities on Fire" lyric from earlier. Dylan tells us of this change in the chorus lines of "Curtain rising on a new age, see the groom still waiting at the altar." You feel like he's singing about the start of a new world. It's a world where some are going to be left behind, possibly the non-believers, possibly those who abuse religion. They're the ones who are still waiting at the altar. You could even go so far as to suggest that Jesus is the bridegroom. He's leaving those others behind. And this isn't too out of the question. Jesus is often referred to as the bridegroom in various versions of the Bible, in Matthew 9:15 and Mark 2:19 and Luke 5:34. The apostles are referred to as the friends and guests and children, depending on the translation, of the bridegroom, who is commonly accepted to be Jesus Christ. This feels like, once again, Dylan is saying, just like he's done in countless other songs of this period, you better get ready for the return of Jesus because the world is falling apart and some won't make it out alive. Finally, I love the lyrics. "Mistake your shyness for aloofness, your shyness for snobbery. which, given all we know about the man Bob Dylan, might be one of the most honest lines he's ever written. It feels like it fits him to a T. I'm not an expert of musicians, certainly not in Bob's league, but I've met a fair few during my work life, and more often than not, they're a curious mix of shy and desperate for the limelight. This feels like it might be Bob painting a quick self-portrait as a misunderstood man in the middle of all this chaos. Regardless, this song is a high point for the album, despite not being perfect. It also continues a long tradition in this era that has been carried over to other eras too, and that's Bob leaving good songs off of albums. Like we saw with Caribbean Wind, this didn't make the original vinyl pressing. Instead, it became a B-side for Heart of Mine. Thankfully, unlike Caribbean Wind, this would actually end up on the track listing of subsequent releases. It also, despite its religious undertones, isn't overtly religious in the same way that other songs are on these albums. And that's another theme on this record. It's just a little more secular. This is also present in track 8, In the Summertime. Once again, Bob is talking about religion, but in a less obvious way. In fact, he could be announcing all is not what it seems with God. It's a wistful song, a retrospective casting of the eye over a relationship. But instead of singing about a woman, Dylan is singing about the Almighty. He doesn't come out and say it, but the tranquil sonics and Bob's contemplative delivery feels like he's looking back at a relationship that's past. In the summertime when you were with me, he ruefully sings on the chorus. We're on the same subject matter as songs like Property of Jesus, in that Bob is protecting his relationship with God despite critical outside forces, but here it's all in the past tense. Strangers, they meddled in our affairs. Poverty and shame was theirs, is the opener of the third verse. And on the verse before, we hear him sing, our loyalty they tried to win, but you are closer to me than my next of kin. The feeling of it all being in the past is laced over the first verse too, as Bob delivers lines like, did you respect me for what I did, or what I didn't do, or keeping it hid? Did I lose my mind when I tried to get rid of everything you see? In the opening lines of a song, it's suggested this relationship took place outside of reality. It's as if this was a perfect harmony to begin with, but it couldn't survive in the real world. The lyrics at the start are, I was in your presence for an hour or so, or was it a day I truly don't know, where the sun never set, where the trees hung low, by the soft and shining sea. With that sun that never sets and the soft sea lines, it feels like a dreamlike existence. That while a good idea at the time, sadly wasn't sustainable. It's like going to the gym every day, it's fine for a while, but then life gets in the way. This is the same thing, you get the impression that it was good for a time, but it's just not going to continue. But just like we're going to see with Dylan's relationship with God after these records, he isn't completely letting go. The closing line suggests he's been forever changed by this relationship for the better. It's become a big part of him. He sings, and I'm still carrying the gift you gave. It's a part of me now, it's been cherished and saved. It'll go with me unto the grave and into eternity. And I'm still carrying the gift you gave. It's a part of me now, it's been cherished and saved. It'll be with me unto the grave and then into eternity. As we'll see, Dylan didn't just banish God from his lyric book at the end of these three albums. Just like before them, God is still very present in his work, but it definitely doesn't seem as clean-cut as it was before. There is evidence to suggest this song could be about the prostitution of the world. The narrator could easily be seen as someone singing about the perfect world that God made that was then ruined by man. That allusion to the Genesis flood narrative with the line, then came the warning that was before the flood, fits this perfectly. But for me, the yearning behind the song feels like it could be closer to Dylan's heart than just another Bible song. Unlike a lot of Shot of Love, we dispose with the anger and irritation here and find ourselves bobbing along with a cool melody that briefly nods to funk and reggae rock in its looseness and its guitar licks. Due to the fact they don't pack the track with instruments means that for one of the few times on this record it doesn't sound cluttered, despite the fact the production is minimal. We also get a harmonica riff too, it follows each chorus acting as a musical bridge or a riff come second chorus. It's something we've seen in pop music for years and years and years, becoming commonplace even today with artists like Calvin Harris and Avicii. We'll be right back. This is one of my favourite songs on the album, but by the next track, Trouble, the rage has returned. Here, Dylan basks in the delights of the Great Tribulations. This is a period supposedly mentioned by Jesus as part of the end times, a period of great suffering where everyone will experience worldwide hardships of disasters, famine, war, pain, and suffering, which doesn't sound too dissimilar to what we're going through today. This would affect all of creation and precede judgment of the wicked people on earth when the second coming takes place. Here, Dylan is almost willing this to rain down upon the earth as he sings, "Trouble in the city, trouble in the farm. You've got your rabbit's foot, you've got your good luck charm, but they can't help you none when there's trouble." And later, drought and starvation, packing of the soul, persecution, execution, governments out of control. And finally, in the penultimate verse, "Since the beginning of the universe, man's been cursed by trouble." This is perfectly hung over some blues rock sonics with another very obvious blues guitar riff. Percussion here is great, with its strident tapping on the snare getting a boost from an almost obnoxious organ sound and some big guitars. I wouldn't call the sound groundbreaking, but it's not bad. And that's just a problem in this era. As we've seen, it's a good mix of interesting sonics that Bob does well. The sonics have always been a part of Dylan's career that is not dwelled on enough by the casual observer. But while the sonics are interesting, we cannot help but compare them to 60s Dylan. No matter how hard you try, you can't get away from comparing this work to his best. Taken out of that context, this is a good album, but against Bob's best, it pales into insignificance. The only time we do get a contender in the fight for this album is on the LP's closer, Every Grain of Sand. Right at the end of this period, on the final track, Dylan delivers its best song. In fact, it's one of the best songs of his entire career. This is up there with Mr. Tambourine Man and Blowing in the Wind and Simple Twist of Fate and all the others. It has their gravitas. There's that feeling of something important going on between the lines and between the notes. Bob's greatest gift has always been capturing a feeling in a song. This is at its best when it's reflective and thoughtful. We saw it on Chimes of Freedom and we get it here. This feels like it's that song's older and wiser brother. The lyrics are just so wonderful as a poem without music. I thought I'd recite them for you in full now. "In the time of my confession, in the hour of my deepest need, when the pool of tears beneath my feet flood every newborn seed, there's a dying voice within me reaching out somewhere, toiling in the danger, in the morals of despair. Don't have the inclination to look back on any mistake. Like Cain, I now behold this chain of events that I must break. In the fury of the moment, I can see the master's hand in every leaf that trembles, in every grain of sand. Oh, the flowers of indulgence and the weeds of yesteryear. Like criminals, they've choked the breath of conscience and good cheer. The sun beat down upon the steps of time to light the way, to ease the pain of idleness and the memory of decay. I gaze into the doorway of temptation's angry flame, and every time I pass that way, I always hear my name. Then onward in my journey, I come to understand that every hair is numbered like every grain of sand. I have gone from rags to riches in the sorrow of the night, in the violence of a summer's dream, in the chill of a wintry light. In the bitter dance of loneliness fading into space, in the broken mirror of innocence on each forgotten face. I hear the ancient footsteps like the motion of the sea. Sometimes I turn, there's someone there, other times it's only me. I am hanging in the balance of the reality of man, like every sparrow falling, like every grain of sand." The words are mesmerizing. Bob reports that it came to him in one go and that's it. No editing, no tortured weeks trying to make it work. It just was as it is. Noel Gallagher once said, "The best songs fall out of the sky," and here that's happened to Dylan. This incredible journey he'd been on over these albums during this point of his life flows out here in 6 minutes and 12 seconds as he channels William Blake's verse from The Auguries of Innocence. The lines in that poem are, "To see a world in a grain of sand and a heaven in a wild flower." Bob puts this into a song that tackles all the big questions. It wanders around life and the world and its meaning. Again, just like in Chimes of Freedom, Bob is singing about trying to make sense of everything. He's seeing the big picture from detail. The grain of sand is tiny and the world is huge. The idea that heaven is also huge, so that a single flower is a tiny reflection of a much greater beauty. A sense of wonder and awe. For Blake and Dylan, these tiny things, that grain of sand and that flower, both reflect and contain aspects of the whole world and the whole of existence. The grain of sand and the flower become metaphors for a hidden beauty, for a divinity in the mundane. Bob thinks of his own existence with lines like, "I have gone from rags to riches" in the fifth verse. He muses over God and the order of the universe with the lines, "I come to understand that every hair is numbered like every grain of sand." Moving over to ideas such as fate and consequences in the final lines of, "I am hanging in the balance of the reality of man like every sparrow falling like every grain of sand." That's possibly a reference to a line in Hamlet, "There is a special providence in the fall of a sparrow," where even a seemingly random act like a dead bird falling from the sky has been a long time in the making by any number of forces, not least of which is possibly God. Of course, there's references to religion too. Bob compares himself to Cain, who in the Bible killed his brother and was banished to wander the earth. Bob's doing the same, seemingly with a head full of thoughts, as he sees God everywhere in every leaf that trembles and every grain of sand. Later, he once again discusses his faith, and not for the first time on this album, we hear him mention temptation. "I gaze into the doorway of temptation's angry flame, and every time I pass it, I always hear my name." Dylan is once again pondering his relationship with God. Musically, the Sonics create the right atmosphere that give a stunning supporting performance to the lyrics. They never try and match them for size. We don't have any crashing cymbals or overblown orchestral breaks. Instead, they play it relatively simply, and like we saw on In the Summertime, that manages to paper over the cracks of the production and the mix. As has happened time and time again over these albums, the backing vocals are crucial. They create a sad beauty, a quiescent hum that sounds like their soundtrack in the soil being thrown over a coffin of this era of Bob's work.
Then onward in my journey, I come to understand that every hair is numbered like every grain.
That harmonica solo with some light sax at the end adds to all of this as Bob plays us out, giving us a moment to reflect on this world. The song's depths and strong core are proven when we look at an early demo version, complete with a dog barking in the background. Even in this form, it still sparkles.
I come to understand that every hair is numbered like every grain of sand.
It's a shame the rest of the album didn't play like this, as this soaring high reminds us there are quite a few lows too. Watered Down Love is a catchy quasi-funk tune that, guess what, references the Bible, and also searches for pure love. Love is at the centre of Bob's mind for the title track too, as we find him looking for hope in a hopeless world. He needs love. Perhaps it's God's love, or perhaps it's human love. We just don't know. He once again sounds angry, like he's being taken over by a brimstone and fire preacher, as he bellows, "Why would I want to take your life? You've only murdered my father, raped his wife, tattooed my babies with a poison pen, mocked my God, humiliated my friends. I need a shot of love. I need a shot of love." By the end of the song, he's still furious and he's still direct. He sings, "If you're a doctor, I need a shot of love." This is all voiced over R&B guitars and a funk bass with that clouded, muddied production. Some are big fans of his song, but for me, the whole thing is a little lukewarm. Elsewhere, unfortunately, we're back onto Reggae by Numbers on Dead Man, Dead Man, which acts as an unwanted part two to Slow Train Cummings' Man Gave Names to All the Animals. Although thankfully here, it's not quite as grating. Another track, Heart of Mine, is back to the funkier side of things, but it doesn't particularly do anything. An earlier performance was already selected for use when Dylan decided to re-record the track with Ronnie Wood and Ringo Starr. In an interview from 1984, Dylan admitted the song was done a bunch of different ways, but I chose for some reason a particularly funky version of that, and it's really scattered. It's not as good as some other versions, but I chose it because Ringo and Ronnie Wood played on it. We did it in like 10 minutes. To be honest, the fact that it was done in 10 minutes shows. We slip into territory found on Empire Burlesque and some other albums of this decade which feature some underwhelming celebrity cameos. Most bizarre of all, though, is track 4. We have a teary-eyed ballad about an American stand-up comedian called Lenny Bruce.
Lenny Bruce is dead, but his ghost lives on and on.
We already know from past episodes of this podcast that Bob loves an outlaw, and here he's relating to Bruce just in the same way he found common ground with Billy the Kid or John Wesley Harding. He gives us lines about Lenny Bruce being dead, but his spirit living on, and not winning any Golden Globe awards, and the fact he was an outlaw. You feel Bob is pointing the finger at the establishment for marginalising a talent here. Bruce would have an eventful career. It was full of legal issues and drug addiction. Perhaps Dylan, marginalised for this religious period, subconsciously felt he too was in the same boat as Bruce, an outcast. Bob himself says he has no idea why he wrote it, but he did, and here it is on the album. The Sonics don't help the slightly strange eulogy, which is even stranger when you consider that Bruce died in 1964 and this song was written in 1980. It's not even a current piece. It's a piano ballad with a nondescript melody that just goes round and round. It aims to be a song like Dark Eyes from Empire Burlesque or What Good Am I from Oh Mercy, but it falls short of creating that special poignant feeling in the Sonics. Instead, it sounds like a parody of those songs. This song, like we've seen on a lot of this LP, is about as far away from religion and the Bible as we get in this three-album era. This often angry, muddied, unfocused album strays further back to the secular than we have done before. This is something Bob would continue further with subsequent releases. But after a rocky phase with Jesus and his fanbase, what would a return to less religious overtones do for Bob's output? That's something we look at next time.
You can play with fire, but you'll get the bill. Don't let her know. Don't let her know that you love her. Don't be a fool, don't be blind. Heart of mine.
Thank you for listening to this episode. As usual, share your thoughts on it and the album. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Bob Dylan Podcast. So next time, it's the final episode of this season, and I thought it'd be nice to do a kind of mini episode on what happened next, because we've covered the religious albums of this period. We've also had a look at how this period came about with a kind of, I guess, an origin story to be grandiose about it. And I thought it'd be nice to do a kind of like a sequel to that and to see what happened next. Because I think to the casual observer, to people that aren't Bob Dylan fans, they just see this whole thing as Bob not being a religious person, then going really religious, and then just dropping God and religion straight away after. But obviously, as we know, that's not really the case. He's always had religion somewhere in his music. So I thought it'd be nice to have a look at where he went from here in terms of God with his output. So join me next time for a mini bonus little kind of special episode to finish off the season. Until then, thank you once again for listening, and goodbye.